This podcast is being recorded at Douglas College in New Westminster, British Columbia, which is located on the unceded traditional and ancestral territories of the Kakait and Kwikwetlem First Nations. We are fortunate to be able to gather on this territory of the Coast Salish peoples, where we honor their welcome and graciousness to the students who seek knowledge here. Thank you.
Welcome to Shift, Let's Talk. In our second edition, we have Sarah Painter, instructor at Douglas College. Hey, Sarah, thank you very much for joining me.
I'm happy to be here.
Thank you. Well, Sarah is a human geographer, and her academic work focuses on geographies of identity, difference, and belonging. I'm so glad that you're here with me. It's a total honor for me to have you here. And I'm Anna Brito, and this is part of the Impact series. Okay, so today we'll be talking about geography, space, and power, and how everything's intertwined, and how they come together, right? So I have a very first question for you, and that is like, we will be talking about how place and space play an important role in power. And we know that some places should be safe spaces, like the home, the university, right? There are spaces where we study, where we live, where we spend lots of time, but they turn to be unsafe spaces for women mostly. Why does this happen? Why do you think it happens?
Mm-hmm. So I think I'll just say something about geography, because often people think that human geographers or geographers study like the material world, just things that we touch. And so a lot of responses to, say, women having fear in public space or being unsafe at home or university, a lot of people will assume, well, we need to remake the space. So one of the ways to make women feel safer in public space is often people will say, well, we need more street lighting. And while that is an effective means for reducing fear of crime, it's a tangible change. And when we want to think about what power is, it's often untangible or intangible, even though it has material repercussions. And so one of the things we look at is how definitions of gender, how gender is constructed in ways to actually render women or femininities and also all sorts of, you know, intersections out of place at universities. I mean, if a university is understood to be a space for learning and has so traditionally been associated with masculinity, and even intellect, rational objective thinking, assumed to be something that men have and women somehow lack, women, and sexual minorities and people with disabilities are all assumed to somehow not have rational thinking, then automatically, in very intangible ways, right, in sort of intellectual and the way in which knowledge is even produced about these people's identities, means they don't really belong in schools. And so it's not just women, it's also certain age groups, so that are mature students considered out of place in the classroom, right? Just the lack of access to gender-neutral washrooms mean that non-binary folks and gender non-conforming folks really don't have spaces. It's all this kind of coding. It's both the material infrastructure, but also the immaterial or the non-material geographies, the meaning that produces these whole things that, you know, we might call landscapes of power, so that some people naturally belong, right, are coded in all sorts of ways to belong, and other people don't get to belong there.
So what you're saying is that some places are mostly belong to men or women, and that is really important, because you can be out of place. Like, for example, if I'm a woman and I'm walking at night at some neighborhood, I might be out of place. But if it was the case for a man, it would be okay, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, it depends on where we're talking about, but generally, a lot of people have written about what you're talking about in terms of fear, and that women have a very elevated, especially in you know, Western and highly urbanized societies, that women, studies show that women disproportionately fear public space. They feel like they're going to be attacked in public spaces. And indeed, sometimes are. But actually, women face violence and sexual violence disproportionately in private spaces and disproportionately at the hands of someone they know, not a stranger. So there's this kind of mythology about strangers jumping out and attacking women. And again, I don't want to minimize that because it does actually happen to a number of people, especially Indigenous, Black, and other women of color, and also sexual minorities and gender non-conforming folks disproportionately face violence. But it's, again, if we really look at what's happening with gender and violence, it's disproportionately something people face at home or in private spaces, which of course is interesting because our sort of history of gender analysis of the city suggests that men have been given this sense of belonging in public spaces and in downtown cores, and that women somehow belong in the private spaces of the home. So basically what we're saying is like, wow, if we sort of reflect just generally speaking, women belong at home in these reproductive, nurturing, you know, childcare and domestic roles, according to a lot of, you know, social discourse. And yet those are the spaces that they're most subject to violence. And that creates a real dilemma. And women feel unsafe in public spaces, especially at night, and especially alone. And yet those are the spaces where actually men are more subject to violence. So, and again, I'm speaking generally, right? Different communities could have different experiences, and I'm really focusing on research that's been done in Western urban spaces.
So women who are generally associated with private spaces, like you said, because we're taking care of the children or the elderly or cooking or cleaning, we are in unsafe spaces, so we should be safe because it's our home, but we're getting killed or we're suffering from violence and sexual harassment and all these kind of nasty things. And I think this is a really important conversation now that with the COVID, because with the COVID situation, we're mainly staying at home, right? So where we should feel safe, it's quite the opposite, where it's totally unsafe. Mm-hmm. And because if it's a private space, it's even harder to ask for help, right? Because we should be bringing someone from the outside to help us navigate our own private spaces.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. There's multiple studies actually already published, right? So we're talking in September 2020, and already multiple studies have been published, not just in newspapers, but academia. My students this summer did COVID projects, and most looked at increase in not just domestic abuse, but also also parental abuse, rising incidents as people are more and more trapped at home. And we really should point out that this is about women who are in relationships, both with men and with women. And so I don't know data on same-sex male couples. And I haven't seen data on polyamorous communities, but women who are with other women, women who are with men, are facing high rates of violence. So again, sometimes people think this is specifically men committing violence, but in lesbian relationships, there's also quite a high recorded incidence in North America of domestic abuse as well.
So how can we change this idea of private space versus the public space, being feminine versus masculine? How can we work around this idea and changing this a little bit?
Well, I mean, one of the things we can do is not just talk about men and women, because that is really just reifying a gender binary that doesn't represent everyone. We need to really have really important conversations about what we even mean when we're talking about gender, and really get people to understand the biological essentialisms, the false biological, false biologies of gender. And by that, I mean like this assumption of gender being natural. And that's not to say gender is unnatural or it's fake, right? Because all of us, all genders, all gender identities can have, you know, really strong sense of masculinity, femininity, and actually both of those things at the same time, or maybe feel, you know, be, have masculine and identity and expressions in some geographies and feminine in others. Like this is very well recorded. But what we just really need to see, without trying to imply that gender's fake, again, that really upsets a lot of people. I think they think that when people say social construction of gender, they're talking about gender being fake. But really saying that these things aren't inherently natural, which means that you aren't born into a life of domesticity. Any gender can be domestic. Any gender can be nurturing. Any gender can be violent, right? And so there's a huge numbers of books out there now by biologists, neuroscientists, people on the science side who've been pointing out neurosexism. Basically, the fact that studies have only specifically tried to look at differences between so-called male masculine and female feminine, like a binary, right? When in fact, a huge number of studies are never published because they fail again and again to prove that there's actually fundamental differences. And of course, there are some differences in people's bodies and people's brains and people's hormonal structures, but they're actually a lot more varied than just two groups. And there's a huge amount of overlap, of course. And actually, men's brains and women's brains, and even actually even our reproductive organs aren't as radically different. Of course, some people have a uterus and some people don't, but things like ovaries and gonads aren't actually radically different, especially when we look at the development of a fetus, that there's very specific things have to happen to essentially turn on different functions and maybe make you like more likely to be assigned female or male at birth. Or maybe mean that you fall into this very wide category of intersex that doctors have created sort of one group, but it's actually a giant array of possibilities there. And for me, that's just so important because, of course, people really fundamentally believe that, first of all, women have a womb, which is not the case, that all women menstruate, which is not the case. And I'm not just talking about trans women. I'm talking about many women, right, have hysterectomies or postmenopausal or premenstrual, right? Like there's a huge variety of people out there. But somehow people really fundamentally believe that women's brains are wired a certain way or their bodies are a certain way. And that means that they are naturally belong at home. And if we look at the history of humanity, we can see that actually wasn't always the case. There's a sort of mythology of women being in the cave, tending to children, like for all eternity, and now it's the home and the suburbs. But of course, there's a huge variety of cultures and times in which humans have lived on Earth, where people of all genders have gone out and hunted and gathered and built homes and done farming together alongside each other. Not all societies were highly gendered. And also where there are gender divisions, they're not really like women are soft. A lot of communities around the world and across time have seen women as actually great sources of power and strength. And so this idea of like, you know, keeping women at the home is very specifically sort of a contemporary idea, rooted in all sorts of false ideas about what men and women can and can't do.
And I believe that's really important now, again, with COVID, because women that are working at home, they're just like juggling, right? The kids and doing everything at their place and working. And mm-hmm. I see that they're, again, the ones that are suffering and are there with all the burden and all that stuff, which is not easy. And it's they put yeah. in the work at the house, like the non-paid work and the paid work and the kids. And yeah, that's really important. So what you say is that we should be raising, maybe we should be raising our kids in a different way, right? Not to understand that women are supposed to take care of the kids and the elderly and do all the domestic stuff, that anyone can take care of the kids or the grandpas, grandmas, right? So raising families in a different way would be a good way to start. That's really interesting what you say.
Education as well in schools, so that it's also institutionalized. So that even the books that we read don't just recreate these very problematic, you know, woman is nurse and man is doctor. And there's nothing wrong with a man being a doctor and maybe a cisgender woman is a nurse. There's nothing wrong with that. The problem is when that's the only option. And that, you know, doctor is has total authority. Like some of these, we might need to rethink some of our institutions and their power dynamics, especially when they're so gendered.
Yeah. I've been reading that there are some universities that are asking for women in careers like math, engineer, or that kind of careers, because there are no women at all there. It's mostly mm-hmm. men. And I guess that the same thing happens with the doctors and nurses.
And politicians. If you look at Dr. Jeanette Ash, who's in our political science department, she did her PhD on gender inclusive political parties. And basically what she and other people have pointed out is that actually just sitting down and having a conversation as a political party, saying that you want to recognize that there's a gender imbalance and that there need to be more women and non-binary representatives, that there you just need more gender diversity, that it can't be all men and it can't all be, in the case, her PhD was in the United Kingdom, but her research is in Canada, you know, in these white majority societies, that also have like huge diverse ethnicities and religions. You can't just have white men, and that's nothing against white men. But when we do see, you know, our multicultural cities, and then, you know, all our mayors are these white men, and there was a recent study on the city of Vancouver being almost all white men in the city, in the municipality, the municipal government, that's a little bit of an issue. And they're not actually, so her research didn't say we need quotas to have, say, 50% women or something like that. But just having the conversation and actually saying that you're going to commit to supporting female candidates and trans candidates and, you know, GNC candidates, and that actually was enough to boost membership and to really say it and really announce it so that all the people running know that they're going to get support when they come in. Even just that was enough to improve gender diversity in a political party. So like the BC NDP or the Federal Liberals or whatever, you know, pick a political party without actual quotas, just talking.
That's really interesting, because you were mentioning before about intersectionality, right? And it's really important to notice that when we talk about women, it's not just one thing, right? Women can be many things. Like you said, there's no set definition for that. So it's not the same being women and being white than being women and being Black or being Indigenous. And that's really important also with this COVID situation, again, because some people are suffering from not only being a woman, but on top of that, being Black or being Indigenous or whatever, right? So that's really important. And I'm glad that you mentioned that, because you also mentioned like non-binary folks, some other people that that are maybe not even taken into consideration. Mm-hmm. And we need to take a look at those unsafe spaces, because that's where we live, that's where we learn, that's where we play, that's where we grow, and we need to be inclusive, and we need to learn to be together and grow, and basically to make a better place for all, and give space. And I think it's like you said, it's for the benefit of all. It's not because we have to, but we're all gonna benefit from that, right?
Yeah, often people think this, like if you talk about disability rights, that it's actually just about people with disabilities, people who identify as a person with a disability or a disabled person. And this, again, is just like a label that could be really broad. But of course, there's, you know, plenty of research to show that we actually all collectively benefit as a society when there isn't exclusion, disenfranchisement, marginalization, poverty, because disability is directly linked. Just like indigeneity, being indigenous and being a colonized person in a settler colony is very much linked to all sorts of barriers that reproduce poverty. And when we don't actually live in a society where we distrust each other, or we judge each other, or we fear each other, we can't talk to each other because we have certain assumptions, that is not a healthy society. And it's not healthy for everybody involved, right? Mm-hmm. That we all actually benefit from feeling comfortable having each other in the same room. And as a teacher, let me talk about the classroom, because you said, how do we make, you know, the home safe? How do we make university safe? People tried this with women's centers and pride centers, separate spaces can be really important. They can be like such a space for respite, and also just having spaces for things like breastfeeding, or for a place that's sort of more private where you can grab information on STIs and grab free condoms. So it's not just like a, you know, out in the middle of the cafeteria. It's a little bit more private, maybe. There's all sorts of good reasons for having that. But of course, the ultimate goal would be to not need these specific safe spaces. Those would be great activist spaces. They would be clubs or something like that one day. But ideally, you would have the entire institution be safe. But I think as it stands now, most people would agree that some classrooms are safe for some people, but not, and other classrooms don't feel safe. Right? That it really depends on the subject, the curriculum, the instructor, the other students. And so then you can think, okay, those are all points of intervention. How do we change how the instructor teaches, what's in the curriculum, how the students act and interact with each other, so that people do feel safer in those classrooms. And you need the people right at the top too, the administration. Sometimes people think it's the faculty who are at the top. There's all these people above us creating policy. For example, there's been just a very bland, vague statement about Black Lives Matter by the institution I work for since this year, just this whole year. So things are erupting, faculty, students are stressed, especially Black, Indigenous, and people of color, but there's almost no real, sort of from the top anyway, discussion about anti-Blackness in Canada and what the institution is prepared to do about it. Even those things, which sometimes are just, we see as kind of a corporate social responsibility campaign, like trying to look good, are still very important, because it's a messaging. It's like the political party saying, we want women to run. We will support you. Come run with our party. Come do this. And it's just one of the many things that could be done that isn't done.
Great, great. Well, Sarah, thank you very much. This has been awesome. I always love talking to you. I learned so much. And so I really appreciate you taking this time with me to talk about this. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Anna.